It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about new census data out yesterday showing that Hispanics are now the largest minority group here in Wisconsin.
First, for a while now, people have been wondering what kind of impact the internet has on our brains. Well, now we have some data to consider. According to new research, Google is making our memories worse.
Here's the deal. Apparently, if we think we can look stuff up later online, we don't bother remembering it now. But what does that mean about the way our brains function and how it can affect things in the big picture?
Betsy Sparrow joins us now. She's an assistant professor in the psychology department at Columbia University. She did research on the link between Google and memory. Betsy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you and your colleagues ran a series of experiments designed to test the way Google has changed the way we remember. And going in, did you have a hypothesis about what you expected to find?
I did, actually, because there was some old research that my advisor had done when I was in graduate school, who basically he looked at this thing called transactive memory. That's this idea that we have people in our lives who we know they know certain types of things, and so we don't bother to remember those types of things anymore. So, for example, you know, I don't bother to remember sports stats because I know my husband knows them, right? So I can ask him anytime I want, and I can ask him again, right? So I don't have to encode it in my own memory. And so I was watching, you know, an old movie, and I saw an actress whose name I couldn't place. I knew I'd seen her before. And I looked her up, and I said to my husband, you know, what did we do before we had the internet? So I had to look to see first, you know, do we, you know, when we don't know the answers to things, do we kind of automatically think about, you know, our computers, our smartphones, that kind of thing? And the answer to that question was yes. When people don't know the answers to things, they do think about their computers and their smartphones. The second thing we looked at was whether people remembered what they looked up, right? So if they know they can look it up again and again, just like I know I can talk to my husband again and again, do they bother to encode it internally, or do they just leave it in that the computer's transactive memory, if you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that was yes. And so I wouldn't say, actually, that people's memory is getting worse, because the other thing that we found is that the thing that would be beneficial with all of this tons of information that we have online and other places, you know, we're just bombarded with this incredible amount of information that, you know, our grandparents and great-grandparents couldn't even imagine. And so the thing to possibly prioritize in memory is where to find information, right, as opposed to the information itself. If we can keep looking it up over and over again, then the thing that we should be getting good at is, you know, where can I find this quickly? Like, do I remember where to go? And so we tested that and found that people do seem to be prioritizing where to find information over the actual information itself.
So in other words,
I think memory is just changing. I don't think it's becoming poorer. It's just we're evolving a little bit, you know, automatically. And I don't think it's changing our brain architecture at all. That can possibly happen in this short frame of time. It's just that we're remembering differently.
So in other words, if we've got a folder that has, you know, facts about cats of the world. So instead of memorizing all those facts about cats, I might remember instead that all of those facts are contained in a folder on my hard drive called cats.
Right. Or you remember that, you know, you looked on where you found this good information was on Wikipedia or was on some, you know, deeper search and PsycINFO or something like that. And so I think, there's just a shift happening. And of course, I think the things that we do need to remember. So, for example, I'm a psychologist. Right. And so when I read stuff on psychology online, you know, I know people are likely to ask me about those things. Right. And so I still continue to remember it because in the transactive memory system, I'm the expert on psychology things. Right. And so I think what we're doing is we're being smart, just like we always have been with other people, about what to remember and what not to.
Well, does that mean we have
more information that looks, because there's so much more information, it looks like we're not remembering things, right? It looks like we're becoming dumber because we can't remember phone numbers and things like that. But I just don't think that's the case.
Does that mean we have more room in our memories to hold more stuff? Because instead of, learning all these facts, we're just thinking about where they're held?
I mean, that I haven't actually tested. But I think what's happening is that we're just prioritizing our own expertise. And then I think the other thing that's happening, actually, I do have data on this that has been published yet, is that we're becoming more creative in our thinking. And that's because we don't have to be so we don't have to memorize so many things. And memorization and kind of tying up working memory with memorization has been shown to decrease the ability to creatively problem solve. And so we looked at that directly, and we did find a direct correlation between the amount that people remembered and the amount that they were able to solve So the less they remembered, the more they were able to creatively solve problems.
So the Atlantic magazine wrote about your research, and the headline that went along with their story was "Scientific Proof That Google Is Destroying Your Memory." Sounds like you disagree with that. You'd say it's just changing our memory.
Yeah, no, I completely disagree with that. And it's all the data is not in, but everything that I've seen so far does not suggest that. I think the thing that it's just that it's so obvious to us that the internet has become such a a crucial part of our lives, right? So, like, if you don't have your smartphone because you dropped it in the toilet for the day, it's like, you don't have anything, right? I mean, you're completely lost. And I think we don't realize we use people in this way all along, right? And so it feels like it has a greater impact in that, and that maybe something negative is happening. And I just don't think so. A lot of the media that's covered this, not a lot, but a decent amount of the media that's covered this has gotten this wrong. That's not what we meant to say at all.
So one big question about all this, do you think that knowing where the information is held is more useful in today's world than actually owning that information yourself in your own brain?
Well, like I said, I think it depends. So if it's stuff that's not crucial for you to know, then yes, I think it is absolutely beneficial to remember where to find it. I mean, of course, I think it's also beneficial to know where to find the things you need to know and you need to transmit to other people. But I mean, of course, there's always situations where you need to know something yourself, like, I don't know, a disaster preparedness plan or something, right? You know, if you work on an oil rig, you shouldn't rely on, the manual, the online manual to tell you like what to do. You should drill that over and over again so that you get muscle memory and so you have it internalized so that you can put it into place as soon as something negative happens. But for the most part, most information that we come across, is not crucial to us. It's not essential to our, not standing, but our position in the transactive memory network. And so it isn't crucial for us to know, and it's better for us just to remember where.
Does your research suggest that we have a choice, that if I choose to be Johnny Encyclopedia and I want to know all this stuff, that I'll still be able to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a choice, but I really think our brains are so smart that it's an automatic one. So when I read psychology things, I don't say to myself, okay, I need to remember this, right? I just do because, my brain's been set up to remember those kinds of things because I understand, psychology experiments and kind of the history of psychology as most of it as it's gone on. It's easy for me to remember that kind of thing. I also am like kind of a medical person, for my family and friends and stuff like that. So I tend to remember that kind of stuff that I read online, but I don't do it on purpose. And I'll sit there and go, okay, I need to study this. Just like I don't say on purpose when I'm reading, Sports Illustrated, like, oh, the Yankees, last 2000 hitter was so-and-so. I don't say to myself, I don't need to remember that because my husband does. It just happens in an automatic way, which I think is actually really remarkable.
But if you're a student in a school and you're going to be tested on something, you're going to have to make the choice to remember it. So is it still a conscious choice we can make?
Children, I think, are still, in our elementary schools and stuff. And I have a 7-year-old. And, of course, he still needs to remember things because he's not, he doesn't have a computer or his iPad in front of him when he's doing well at this point. I mean, I don't know what he could type. In order for him to type it in, he would have to know it, right? But, I think, of course, there is a place for memorization until you get to the point where, it's not necessarily the most crucial thing you need to know. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, I took an American history class, and we didn't have to memorize any dates. It was all about, what was the meaning, of each of the things that happened in history, and what could we learn from it. And I think that level of understanding is more difficult. Memorizing something is actually pretty easy. And so that's kind of a next level. And so, as you get to, say, college students and people like that, they have to do the trade-off and kind of figure out what type of class they're in. Are they in a class that's like more memorization-based, like a pre-med type class? Or is it more kind of, an analytical and critical thinking? So it's going to be a mixture of both always, I think.
Well, Betsy, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
We've been talking to Betsy Sparrow, an assistant professor in the psychology department at Columbia University. She conducted experiments with some cohorts of hers looking at Google and memory.
Hispanics now make up the largest minority group in Wisconsin at 6.34% of the population. That's according to new U.S. Census data out yesterday. African Americans previously made up the state's largest minority group. They're now second with 6.26%, just a little bit behind.
The trend of a growing Hispanic population has been clear since the early 1980s, quintupling since then from 60,000 to over 350,000.
Here with us to talk about the growing Hispanic population here in Wisconsin is Enrique Figueroa. He's director of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Roberto Hernandez Center. That center serves Latino students at UWM and the community of southeastern Wisconsin as well. Enrique, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, as we said, this isn't a new trend, a growing Hispanic community. Did you expect, though, that Hispanics would make up the largest minority group in the state in 2014?
I was off probably a year. My calculations indicated that probably would be a year from now. But actually, the data that the census is reporting is as of July 13. Hmm. So it would, my calculation would be July 14. So we all knew that it was going to happen. It was just a matter of when it would happen.
And which parts of the state are seeing most of the growth of the Hispanic population?
Well, in total numbers, Milwaukee County is probably leading the state because the base is so large. But places like Brown and Dane and Kenosha and Racine and Rock and Walworth are probably the largest, the counties with the largest Hispanic population. But you'll find Latinos or Hispanics in every county in the state now. And if you look at the chart that the Journal Sentinel published today, I mean, there's some counties that had growth rates of 600%, I think, was the highest from 2000 to 2013. So, yeah, I have it here. Crempolo County increased, the Hispanic population increased by 655%, which is the highest growth rate of any county. So, but the base was pretty small.
Mm-hmm. So who is driving this growth? Are we talking about immigrants moving straight to Wisconsin or people who have been in the U.S. for one, two, or more generations?
No, most of the growth now is coming from what we call native-born Hispanics. In the 90s and into the 2000s, a good amount of the growth was coming from immigrants. But now it's native-born Hispanics, i.e. people that are born here and are American citizens.
Right. Wisconsin's not traditionally a point of entry for new immigrants. We're not near a coast or a national border. So it's people who maybe came in a generation or two possibly into the U.S. Where do we know regionally where they're coming from in the country?
There's a good amount of individuals that are Latinos or Hispanics in Wisconsin that are originally from Texas. The migrant stream in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s for agricultural work originated with a number of people from Texas, and those individuals settled out. So Texas is a big contributor. A number of people came to Chicago, northern Illinois, and over time they decided to go further north. So entry point was Chicago, but subsequent generations, people moved to Wisconsin. So, and there's also more recent immigrants that have come in the 90s and the early 2000s from different parts of Mexico, and their children are the ones that are leading to this growth that we see manifested in today's or yesterday's report.
Is there anything that Wisconsin needs to reassess or change when it comes to our politics or our social attitudes considering the growth of the Hispanic community?
Well, as you know, depending on how attuned the people are to the news, your listeners, the people that are more attuned probably knew that this was developing nationwide. The Latino population surpassed the African-American population some years back. So there is some, in my judgment, some things that people need to be aware of and perhaps concerned about, and that is that the Latino population is a relatively young population. The percentage of the total population that is under 18, for example, is fairly large as compared to the white population in the state or the African-American population. So that what I've mentioned is that the demand on education, whether it's K-12 or higher ed, Latinos have a relatively higher demand because there's relatively more of us that are entering that age group. That is also happening where, at the same time, where we know that investment, particularly in higher ed, is not keeping up or, in fact, not increasing at any rate. So that disproportionately Latinos are getting a disproportionate effect because we're greater demanders for higher ed, if you will. So I think that's one thing in particular that is very important, because 20 years from now, a significant portion of the workforce in the state of Wisconsin are going to be Hispanics, and they need to be educated and trained now, so that in their productive years, in their 40s and 50s, in their peak productive years, they're actually fulfilling their peak performance with the education and training we provide today.
Well, let's start with kindergarten through 12th grade. Are there things that schools maybe should be doing differently, especially schools that are seeing the higher rates of growth in the Hispanic population?
Well, one thing that I would argue is that you certainly need to recruit more Latino and Hispanic teachers. One is because most of those individuals are generally bilingual, and you need to have individual teachers that can communicate well with parents. I mean, the kids will learn English and speak English, but a good number of parents are still monolingual Spanish speakers, so the ability of a teacher to be able to communicate directly with a parent, I think, is important, and so their bilingual capabilities are important. But not only bilingual capabilities, bicultural capabilities, because there are some cultural issues that facilitate learning, facilitate the understanding of the dynamics of how a household, Latino household functions versus a non-Latino household. So having a higher percentage of Latino teachers in the teacher corps, I think, is very important.
What kind of cultural issues, cultural barriers might there be between a family and a school in this case?
Well, there's this whole issue of respect. I mean, a lot of parents in Central and South America and in Mexico view teachers as being very respectful individuals, so generally they will not raise many questions, they will not challenge anything that's going on with the teaching of their children. And at times we do need parents to be a little bit more engaged and a little bit more critical of whether Mario or Juanita are getting a good education or not. So that's number one. Number two is that there is this tendency of people to leave education to the teachers and the professionals. They know what's going on better than what we would be able to contribute. And parents kind of discount their ability to influence what should be happening in the schools and their children.
Now, how about cases where a student might need some help with English as a second language? Is Wisconsin ready to meet their needs?
I don't know specifically the number of English as a second language programs out there, so I can't comment directly on it. I would speculate that there's probably a greater demand for those kind of services than what's currently being supplied, but I can't give you any hard numbers on that.
Okay. And speaking of education, we've talked a lot about educational disparities between white and black populations in schools, disparities health, income, educational outcome in particular. Do you see Latinos having a similar disparity?
Yes. The disparities exist. The disparities are not as large as compared between whites and African Americans, but they are still there. I mean, Latinos generally fall somewhere in between. If I'm just picking numbers here, if the whites are at 10 and African Americans are at 5, Latinos would generally fall about 7, perhaps 8 or 6. So the disparities exist. They have been persistent. And we need to think in terms of how to narrow those gaps, not only for Latinos, but for African American students as well.
And also, just looking at disparities, we see great segregation, large amounts of segregation, especially in the Milwaukee area, sometimes called the most segregated in the country. How does that play out with the Hispanic community in Wisconsin? Is there that kind of radical segregation here in the state?
I don't know if I would use the term radical because, again, I haven't seen any hard data similar to the hard data that's documented the white and African-American segregation. But if you look at the South Side, I mean, people would historically and contemporaneously say that a large chunk of the Latino population is in the South Side, which is true. But you are seeing Latinos now moving more west and south within Milwaukee County. But you also see Latinos in other parts of the county, in other parts of southeastern Wisconsin. So I would speculate that the segregation is there, but the severity or the degree to which it exists in the African American white communities is not as severe as in the, let's say, the white and Latino communities. But it is there. There is some segregation.
We're speaking with Enrique Figueroa. He's director of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Roberto Hernandez Center. U.S. Census data out yesterday shows that Hispanics are now the largest minority group here in Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you on this one. Are you one of the Hispanics in Wisconsin that we're talking about? We'd like to hear your story. Have you noticed demographic shifts? And what do you think Wisconsin can do to be more inclusive of minority groups? If you belong to a minority group, how has a Wisconsin majority group responded to you? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back with Enrique Figueroa, director of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Roberto Hernandez Center. We're talking about new U.S. Census data out yesterday showing that Hispanics are the largest minority group in Wisconsin now at 6.34% of the population.
And we'd like to hear from you. Those are the big numbers, the big data from the census. Can you put a human face on this for us? Are you one of the Hispanic community here in Wisconsin? Have you been here for years? Did you just move here? Did you just move here from another part of the country or another part of the world? What's Wisconsin like from your eyes? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or do you work in the schools? Are you dealing with having English as a second language classes, reaching out to parents in the Hispanic community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Enrique, I'd like to ask a basic language question. I've been stumbling a little bit over going back and forth between the phrases Hispanic and Latino. Can you tell me what's the appropriate usage?
Well, I think both of them are appropriate. People would say that Hispanics has certainly been around longer. It probably goes to the Nixon administration when it was first coined. Latinos is a relatively newer term. Some people would say it is probably a more progressive term. But both are appropriate.
All right. And I wanted to talk about politics a little bit. Every now and then around election time, you see a lot of articles about what is the Latino vote going to do in this race, usually for president or the U.S. Senate. Is it that simple? Is there such a thing as a Latino vote, or is it a little more complicated than that?
Well, there is, Latino voters, obviously, but we're not a monolithic entity. Contrary to African-American voters, which historically have been Democratic voters in the 90 percentile range, Latinos are not that much inclined to vote democratically as, say, African-Americans. President Obama got about 70% of the Latino vote in his last election, which is fairly high. President Bush too, he probably got the highest Latino vote at 41% in his first election. So in certain states, in the presidential election, the Latino vote was critical in swinging the state's electoral college votes into the column of the last two elections, the President Obama's column. Here in Wisconsin, as some of your listeners would agree with, is that roughly about 48-49% of the electorate is likely to vote Republican, and another 48 or 49% is likely to vote Democratic. So you have a relatively small number of the electorate that will swing the election one way or the other. And in this respect, Latinos representing 6.5% of the total electorate, but about probably closer to 3%. 6.5% of the total population, but only about 3 or 4% of the electorate because of we're young and some of us are not citizens. So I think both parties are going to put significant resources in convincing Latino voters out there to vote their party. So, and they may indeed play a crucial role in this November's election.
Do we see discrimination against Latinos here in Wisconsin? We've seen lots of waves of immigration from different places around the world over years. Those immigrants have encountered varying degrees of hostility and welcome. What would you say Wisconsin is doing when it comes to Hispanics?
I think indeed most Hispanics in the state of Wisconsin will tell you that at some point in their lives they've experienced discrimination in one form or another. The national surveys substantiate that. So in terms of how discrimination is manifested, a number of folks would tell you that if they don't speak English, as most people do, i.e. that there's an accent detected, people conclude that because of your inability to speak English well, that they conclude that you're somehow less able to do other things, i.e. you're not as smart, perhaps you're stupid, and that is certainly not the case. Two is that a number of Latinos that have been here in this country for a number of generations feel the wrath of some folks that are anti-immigrants, and because your skin is a particular color, i.e. similar to the immigrant's color, that a lot of people conclude that you're an immigrant, even though you've been here for generations, so that you're not as truly accepted as an American as most people would like.
Back in May, immigration agents, speaking of the immigration issue over in Milwaukee, arrested and detained 22 people. Some had committed violent crimes, were gang members, they said. Others hadn't committed crimes apart from their immigration statuses. How does the immigration debate affect Latinos in Wisconsin, and how do they look at that issue?
Most Latinos here in the state of Wisconsin, I would argue, have relatives or friends that are immigrants. Indeed, my parents were immigrants. I was born here, but both my father and mother were born in Mexico. So we have direct connections, affiliations with immigrants at one point in our lives. So we recognize and understand what immigrants go through in this country. And therefore, we're very supportive of having comprehensive immigration reform completed so that people can move on with their lives. The debate, as you know, created a good amount of polarization in folks in our country. Some people are very supportive of comprehensive immigration reform, and other people are not very supportive. So the folks that are not very supportive kind of paint all of us in the same brush. When they see you walking down the street, people conclude that you're an immigrant, and you may not. So people don't want to be treated that way.
You've been watching these population trends. You said the rise of Hispanics as the largest minority population in the state was a year or so ahead of your calculations. Let's look to the future, though. Are these trends going to keep going in the same direction?
Yes, because, as I mentioned earlier, the growth now, the most of the growth now is coming from native-born individuals as compared to immigrants. So you will see the Latino population continue to grow. Perhaps you will not see it at the growth rates that we saw in the decade of the 90s or the decade of the 2000s, but it will be a continuous and progressive growth rate, and that people will start recognizing that we are contributing factors of our communities. We represent vigor and growth, and over time, we certainly will be fully incorporated in our civic engagements, in our respective communities. I hope that takes place sooner rather than later.
What would you like to see the state do on a policy level and just everyday Wisconsinites do to embrace that future?
Well, certainly one, to invest in education. You know, about 20-something percent of the students in MPS are Latino, for example. It's probably closer to 25%, 1 in 4. Nationwide, that is indeed the case. 1 in 4 of kids under 18 are Latinos, so that a large wave of us will be seeking education. So we need to invest in our educational institutions to provide that kind of knowledge and training for Latinos. Two, I think that it's very important for communities to start engaging and incorporating Latinos in their community so that they feel an investment and a stake in the well-being of the community instead of being outsiders, if you will. And thirdly is to recognize that from an economic development perspective, the more that people are contributing economically, the better for respective communities for them to grow economically. And Latinos are going to be progressively a larger and larger part of that development.
Enrique, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Enrique Figueroa. He's director of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Roberto Hernandez Center, talking about new census data out yesterday showing Hispanics now make up Wisconsin's largest minority group.
It's time for this week's Share Something. The Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City has been sharing a lot lately online. The museum's huge collection of art and artifacts has a growing digital presence for the public to check out and for non-commercial use by scholars, too.
Here to share a tour of that digital museum and some highlights is Sri Srinivasan. He's Chief Digital Officer for the Metropolitan Museum of Art, or the Met, in New York. Sri, thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
So how much of the Met's huge collection is available online for us to check out?
Well, we have 400,000 images that are available online that can be viewed, of course, as much as you want. And then if you want to download them and use them for non-scholarly purposes, for non-commercial purposes, for nonprofit work, you can absolutely download them as well. And this is part of our initiative to get more people to see the museum's art and to enjoy it. We obviously love people having people come to the Met in New York, but not everybody can. And we want people to also experience it online from all over the planet. And so that's why we're making this effort.
Seeing it in person obviously has a huge impact. Do you think that viewing it online has a comparable effect?
Nothing beats being in a museum, being inside a gallery, and just you and the art, no technology. But we, you know, there are so many other circumstances in which we want people to be able to access it, understand it, go deeper, and that's where we've spent a lot of energy and time and resources on metmuseum.org, which is our website, to do that. I was in Milwaukee just a few weeks ago, and I was at your wonderful art museum, and it was so nice to be there and see those art pieces in person. But you can see why not everybody will be able to see it in person.
One fun thing about the using the digital space here is that you can organize the museum in different ways, kind of however you want. And you've got a thing called One Met, Many Worlds, and items are organized in categories not by where they're from or their era, but things like rounded, broken, dark, and youthful. Has the museum staff had a ton of fun coming up with these new ways of compiling the collection?
Right. This was an effort. Thank you for pointing that out. This is a new way to access the collection, which can be seen in so many different ways. And we want to make sure that we have kind of the scholarly, authoritative view into the art, but we also want to have these other kind of non-traditional ways. And so what you're pointing out is a new interactive feature called One Met, Many Worlds that you can go in and kind of have lots of fun with it. And you can put your pairings and your interpretation of the art yourself and share it with the world. So we like that, and that's a great way to bring people in.
That's one advantage, because when I was actually at the Met, it seemed like they weren't going to let me start moving things around and organizing the way I wanted to.
No, not yet.
And it sounds like people can play with the images too, and visitors can pair them up. How does that work?
Well, in this particular feature, which you can find in our collection section, we took our 500 kind of highlight items, and it's part of this guide that our printed guide. We want it to be available online, but we also realize that the way people look at art now, they want to interact, they want to do things with it, they want to share it, they want to mash it up, they want to remix it, and we thought that this would be a fun kind of way for them to find pieces of art that they like, and kind of the juxtaposition and looking at details would be a kind of new way for them to experience the art. We still let you just look at the full object if that's all you want to do, but if you want to get into the details and look at specific things and play them off each other, you can do that as well.
Well, you've shared a handful of works with us, and we've set up our own little gallery of sorts on the Central Time Facebook page. I just put up a thing and then comments with links to 6 or 7 different pieces of art. Now, when you were coming up with these, Sri, did you have a theme in mind, or are you just kind of showing some of the breadth of the online collection?
Well, today we wanted to just show you a breadth. These are not any particular order. We just wanted you to kind of have some fun with it, and I see that you put them up on your Facebook page. So thank you.
Well, let's get into some of the selections that we've got. Wisconsin Landscape by John Stewart Curry is one.
Right, and of course, since it's Wisconsin, I thought that would be something fun for you to share with your audience. What I really like about this is if you go in and, you know, you're just looking at the painting and it speaks for itself. It's obviously a wonderful oil on canvas. But what happens is that this was done at a time when this was just after the Great Depression, and parts of the Midwest were still suffering from the effects of it. But the whole point of this piece of art was to give hope to people. And I think that's something that we can art can do. It can give you solace. It can give you enjoyment, but it can also give you hope. And this particular piece was from an Artist for Victory competition that supported American artists during World War II, and that's when the Met acquired it. And what we do is we collect art from all over the world, and we want to make sure that it's as accessible as possible.
That reminds me, before we get into the other pieces you are sharing today, my understanding of the way museums is work is that sometimes what you see in the museum is just the tip of the iceberg. There are much bigger collections that rotate in and out of storage. Do you use the digital collection in part to help share some of those things that might not even be up on display?
That's correct. That's what we do. We want to make sure that people, scholars, students, and others can have access to the collection and be inspired by it. So there might be a variety of reasons something's not on display. It's on loan to another museum. It's being it's being touched up because it's got some conservation work that needs to happen, or we just rotate it because we want other pieces of art to show up. So by having it online, I think that we're able to give people access to it. And this is all part of kind of where society is going. I think to be successful as an institution, you have to make a connection between the physical and the digital, the in-person and the online. And very much like media, like radio, the way you're using kind of traditional radio but using Facebook, we use these same tools to make sure that people can access it in multiple ways.
Well, another one of the pieces that you suggested is The Death of Socrates. This is an interesting one. He's surrounded by his acolytes, I guess, who are around him. And I'm gathering this is a scene where he's drinking the hemlock. It's a fascinating one to see online.
Yes, and this is our museum is filled with Greek and Roman art from antiquity and from much older vintage. This is our Jacques-Louis David, which was made in 1787. But it tells this kind of ancient story. And what I like about that is that every era was very comfortable looking back to be inspired. And at the Met, we have more than 5,000 years of art from every culture, every civilization. And that's why I thought it might be fun for you all to take a look.
Another one, and this one kind of illustrates some classic American artwork. And well, the 4th of July is coming up, very timely. Washington crossing the Delaware.
Yes, this is, of course, a very famous painting, and it kind of really speaks to you. And I hope your audience will go into the Facebook and then also go online to see this particular artwork. And you can zoom in ways that when you're standing at this enormous canvas, you may not be able to get much closer, but online you can get much, much closer.
And we won't stain it with our noses.
Sri, how unusual is what the Met is doing with this online available collection?
I think a lot of museums are doing this now, and I think we're all trying to make sure that the value of the museum, the case we make for our nonprofit status and everything else, is to get more people to see more of what we do. And you do that not by squirreling things away in the basement or in storage, but by bringing it out. And in a globalized world where so many people are now going to be traveling and experiencing each other's cultures, they love seeing this kind of art online, and we want to be able to do that. And we're part of many, many museums that are doing this. But at the Met, it's all about scale because, obviously, it's a very big place.
Well, we've focused on the paintings you shared so far. Let's get into sculpture. This is a new one to me. Durga as Slayer of the Buffalo Demon Mahisha from Nepal, I think I saw.
And this is a Hindu deity, and my daughter's name happens to be Durga as well.
Oh.
And I was thinking of her today, and I was looking at some of the art, and I thought I'd share this with you. And what you're seeing here is that beauty and the lines in which this piece of sculpture has been was created just shows you how universal the concepts of power and devotion are in one piece of art.
Does your daughter Durga like this one?
She does. she She knows that she's named after a strong and very powerful goddess. She has a twin brother named Krishna, who's also a more playful but powerful Hindu god as well.
Durga is the tiger rider, isn't she?
That's correct.
Okay. Lots of things
you know
to learn.
You know you're Hindu. Okay.
Well, let's move on to a couple of statues that you sent. This is an interesting pairing, young Hercules and older Hercules.
I love this because it's arranged in our Greek and Roman courtyard, and these are two separate statues that were side by side, we presume, when it was when they were together centuries ago. But now we've put them looking at each other, and I've had so many friends and others kind of walk by each of them and not make the connection. But when you look, you'll see it's Hercules in his 20s, let's say, and then there's Hercules in his 50s. And he's carrying with him this lion skin when he's in his 20s. And either it's the same lion skin that he kept for several decades, or goodness knows how many lions suffered at his hands. But it's a very powerful image of somebody who was strong and became older, wiser, but still the strength is at the core of what he looks like.
And the last one you shared, and again, you can see all of these on the Central Time Facebook page, a marble column from a temple of Artemis at Sardis, which was in Persia. Is that right?
And what you're looking at here is a really tall column. And some of you who have studied architecture or looked at, when you look at Hellenistic sculpture and architecture, what you'll see is that we've taken the bottom of this column and the very top of the column and collapsed and put them on top of each other because we don't have space for the full column. But you'll notice how much wider the base is compared to the top. So it was a kind of tapering, very gentle tapering that you will not be able to tell if you're just looking at the column. But this is a very direct way to understand that.
Sri, I'm sure your job's a lot of work, but it sounds like a lot of fun too, isn't it?
It is a lot of fun, and I get to work with some very cool people who want to marry technology and art and help the world.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Sri Srinivasan. He's Chief Digital Officer for the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and we've got a little gallery of the art items we've been talking about, make that visual side of the conversation come alive. You can see them all over at the Central Time Facebook page.